and we're real happy tonight to have Jim Boyd joining us. Jim has retired from the editorial staff at the Minneapolis Star Tribune. About 7 years ago, Jim moved here to Cook County, and he's been a pretty integral part of this community ever since he moved here. Jim has just finished a pretty remarkable book called Sawdust in Their Blood, and this book celebrates the 100-year anniversary of Hesram Lumber Company. Jim, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Thank you.
Thanks for being a part of our community. You've really melded in these 7 years.
Oh, thanks.
You've been very active. Right now, you're the executive director of Cook County. My brain has kind
of
left me. Thank you very much, Jim. Chamber of Commerce, yes. How did you get involved in the book?
You know, I'm not real sure. I've had an association with Sean Parrish and Amber Pratt at Northern Wilds. Mm-hmm. And I think Howard approached them about doing a book, and they approached me. And it's last October, early November, Howard and Jack Hedstrom and Sean and Amber and I sat down and talked about it, and started.
Got evolved, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I thought when you moved here that you might have come to do a little fishing, a little relaxing, you and your wife, Jetty.
Yeah.
But you have been one busy guy since you've been here, and this is another result of what you've been doing. I know you spent a lot of time at the Cook County News Herald going through old issues to look up a lot of this information.
I did. Actually, on the microfiche machine, the old broken microfiche machine that really needs to be replaced in the library.
Oh, that's where you were. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And then also in the files at the Cook County Historical Society, which Carrie made available to me very kindly. So, yeah.
Yeah. And also Bill Raff's book, Pioneers in the Wilderness, was that a good source for you as well?
Yes and no. It was a source. For example, there's a drawing. Actually, Charles Anderson made a drawing in this book that shows the location of Andrew Hedstrom's original homestead. And no one knew where it was, and I found it in the Willis Raff book. Mm-hmm. So it was helpful for that. But Willis Raff was writing the history of Cook County, not of the Hedstrom family. So he might start a story on page 23, and there'd be a little bit more of it on page 387. So finding those pieces was very difficult.
As well as looking through Cook County paper to find pieces.
Yeah. The News Herald was really, really kind of fun because by diligently kind of tracking down the stories that were mentioned in a footnote in the Raff book, and then going back and reading the original, I was able to plot every place that they logged or that they had a logging camp through all the years. And that was really, to me, it was really fun. Because I was telling the heads from some of these places, I don't think they knew that when this started, even before he got this mill up and running again, which no one thought he could do. Andrew had a crew out cutting timber, basically at the intersection of County Road 60, which is the Berglund areas off of that, or Howard lives on that, and Linskoog Road, the northeast section of that. From there is where they logged the first logs for the mill. It was a mile and a half from the mill, I guess. So. Mm-hmm. And he, Andrew had him doing that before he even had the mill running. So.
Yeah. Now, can you give us a description of, or at least as you understand, how Andrew and Alma, what they were like? What age was Andrew when he decided to start a mill, and what had he been doing?
Well, I'd have to calculate his age. He was in his 40s.
Let me put it that way.
He had actually come to Cook County in like 1893, and so the mill started in 1914. The time between, he spent as a carpenter, a very well-respected carpenter and craftsman. For example, you can see his work on the Cook County Historical Society building. It was the lighthouse keeper's house. Andrew, and I believe with his father-in-law, Olaf Berglund, built that. So they did a lot of the buildings around town, and they were very good. And then he turned his back on it. This is the thing that is so amazing to me. Ed Tofte down in Tofte had this old burned out mill that had gotten burned down in a forest fire in 1910 and sat out in the elements for 3 years. And Andrew had 7 children to provide for, was well established in a career as a carpenter and craftsman, turned his back on that, bought this broken down, burned out old mill that no one thought could be made to work again, brought it back up to the shore of Devil Track River. Before it even arrived, built a bunkhouse, a machine shed, a chow hall, and a building for the mill itself, and then had this crew out cutting timber before the pile of junk ever arrived. And then it was Charles Anderson, Wayne Anderson's dad, who actually, I think, was the mechanical genius that actually got the thing running again. But they did succeed.
And this was several tons of equipment that had to be moved before we had roads to move it on.
Absolutely,
basically.
Yeah, they had to move it in the winter. The name of one of the guys who was involved in the move is in the book. I can't recall it right offhand, but it took 2 trips, and there was no real road in a long time to get it up here from Tofte. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Now, that's confidence.
Yeah.
You haven't even got a mill that nobody thinks you can have running, and you're building everything around it.
Absolutely. You know, he really bet the farm, you know. And mm-hmm. and again, 7 children to provide for and to, you know, to do. And they you know, they barely made it. They barely made it. Money got really tight. And they of course, grew a lot of their food. But it was a difficult, difficult dream that he had and made work. And it's a very, very impressive feat, I think, for both of them. Now, the one that shouldn't get missed in this is Alma, because, again, she was either pregnant or had a newborn, because mm-hmm. she had a baby about every 2 years. She's got 7 children. She's doing all the baking. She's doing all the washing. And in those days, the washing was a full day of stuff every week. The gardening, all of this stuff, watching these children. And so Andrew starts this mill, and they have this beautiful house up on Central Maple Hill that he built before they were married. It's a gorgeous place. And he comes home, he says, you know, there's this mill, and it's 2 miles away, and I have to be there and get the boiler started early in the morning, and I have to walk off, and we need to move down there. And by the way, the house is only a third as big as the one you're in now. And also, by the way, you're going to have to start making 3 meals a day for a crew of 15 people. And she did it.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah. And she did it while she continued to have children, because they eventually had 12.
Yes.
So that's amazing to me that she was able to do that. And she's reputed by everybody who actually knew her as being extremely calm, very competent, a very caring person. Andrew was mercurial. He was up and down. Those two, the Hedstrom's family has a lot of fun figuring out who got what of those two traits. I won't say any more about that.
You don't need to speculate beyond that, yeah.
Well, I've had some of them actually say, you know, I certainly got Andrew, or I got Alma. So. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And one thing that's been a big part of their story all through it, and it comes out in your book very strongly, has been fire.
Fire, yeah, absolutely. It was always kind of their nemesis. Again, I don't have a list of all the fires, but the house that Andrew and Alma were inhabiting down by the mill burned down in the middle of January. They had a store of food, because you always got, this was time when there was no road to Duluth, so you got the last ship in the fall to bring in your apples and your potatoes and your, you know, your sugar and whatever. And so their house was full of a store of stuff for the entire winter. It was 20 below zero. House burned down. They moved into the bunkhouse and kept on going. And then repeatedly, the mill burned and they had to start over, or the dry kiln would burn, or, you know, it was a repeated need to begin again. Mm-hmm. And they always, incredible incredibly, they always managed to improve what they had in coming back from each fire. So the most impressive example of that is probably the fire in 1981 that totally destroyed the mill. And Wes was the head of the thing then, and he emphasized, and it's in the news stories, that they wanted to come back and build it better. But they didn't have a lot of money, so Howard and Wayne Anderson went around the country buying up used equipment and bringing it back and then refurbishing it. And Wayne's very proud of this. He said the normal lifespan for this kind of machinery is 20 or 30 years. It's all still running. You know,
yeah, so pretty amazing.
It is.
Plus, they had, I think that was one of Howard's cousins, Dean.
Dean's
to enter into that.
Dean was a computer guy. He still is. He's retired in the cities now, pretty much. But yeah, he did a lot of automation for them. The Headstrom have always been pretty cutting edge as far as keeping up with the new things in the industry. And Dean helped them automate a great deal and save a lot of labor. So the efficiencies of came with that were significant.
And over the years, they either had a lot of talent in the family or they found talent just around them that seemed to be just what they needed for what was called for at the time, such as Charles Anderson right away knowing what to do with that old mill, you know, and you go down to Wayne having the talent that he has and Howard being an engineer and able to do those things. And then a cousin that can do the automation for a computer automation. Yeah. It's just remarkable.
And one that you didn't mention that figures looms very large is Hilding Björklund.
Yes.
He came to the, he's a vet of World War One. He came to the family, or to the Headstrom Lumber, in, I think in his 50s. And they hired him as what they call a pilot. Pilot here and pilot there. But within a day or two, they figured out that that was a waste of his talents because he was apparently surpassed Wayne and Charles Anderson in his mechanical genius. He was just impressive. And he actually taught, Wayne learned a lot from Hilding and became a very impressive millwright in his own right. And he says that Hilding didn't like anybody to watch him. And so he'd always say, well, you're in my light. Get out of the way. Get out of the way. And Wayne says, you know, the light could be coming from the left and I'm on the right side of him. And he's just, you know, he said, but Wayne says, but I was able to surreptitiously watch how he did stuff. And Howard says he's still got some of the things that Hilding made. Oh, by the way, Howard says that he and the other kids called him a welding beer can.
Oh, yeah.
but he says he's just amazed at the beauty of this stuff that Hilding created and how quickly he did it. He just zip, 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 and it was done. So, yeah, so they were very good at finding talent. And they were very fortunate in that regard. Sometimes the talents didn't fit very well. In some regard, I think Phil and Ed, they just really wanted to be in the woods. They just loved being in the woods. Mm-hmm. And Phil loved being on a cat and machinery and things like that. But the pressures of the changes in the industry kind of spelled the end of that. And that was too bad because I think they would have been happier in a way if they could have just continued to, you know, to be in the woods.
And I think what they dropped their own logging operations, what, in the 60s?
In the 60s, but Ed and Phil brought it back a little bit in the early 80s, I think, and it just didn't work.
Just didn't work the second time.
Yeah, it was costing the family too much money.
You know, I think a lot of folks out there may not have the background that some of us do growing up here with logging, but the hardships of logging back in those early days were amazing. Winter logging, horses, trying to build roads, trying to drag huge timbers out. Of course, we had much bigger timbers that they're dealing with. Was not an easy life.
It wasn't, and that's part of the reason it was very late. The heyday of logging in Minnesota overall was in the 1850s, 60s. So we're talking 1910. So it came late because there were no railroads. There weren't, and railroads figured very large in the hauling stuff for logging in other parts of Minnesota. The first efforts up here focused on the rivers. So Schroeder was Schroeder Lumber Company. The Schroeder Lumber Company bought up 20,000 acres on the Cross River drainage, and they would build cofferdams up the Cross River and spend all winter harvesting. And then in the spring, when the water came, the melt came, they would break those cofferdams and flush all the logs into the Big Lake, mm-hmm. and then haul them over to Ashland and other places. So it was a hard life. It was a marginal life. It was never a huge success up here. So it's all the more amazing that the Hedstroms have held on for 100 years, because the timber never grew as thickly up here as it did in a lot of the rest of Minnesota. We're known as a rocky area for a very mm-hmm. good reason, and so it was sparse.
Yeah, it didn't take long to clear all the available timber around the mill that made it easy.
No.
So even today now, so much of the timber that gets processed comes from somewhere else. It has to.
It does. It does, yeah. And the Hedstroms were really severely affected by BWCA. Mm-hmm. They were harvesting big first growth white pine mm-hmm. out of the BWCA, and all of a sudden that was unavailable, and they had to quick shift into make an adjustment to what else was available. So they've figured it. They've kind of carved out an area around the mill where they figure they can buy enough wood without competing with Weyerhaeuser or Potlatch or other big outfits to survive and to do, 15, 20 million board feet of lumber a year, and can do that going forward without seeing the end of it. So that's mm-hmm. that's good. They've kind of found the sweet spot right now.
I think another key, as I read your book, and the way that this has evolved, was the way that they've handled succession within the family. Because so often in family business, especially one that where they have 12 children, is not easy.
It's not. And it has been an issue. The first succession was from Andrew to Roy. And in a way, they were fortunate that Roy was kind of known as the boss mm-hmm. by all the kids. And so it was a natural leadership role that everybody pretty well gave him from the time they were all very young. And so there was just no question that he was going to be he was going to replace Andrew. And then of those brothers, Wes was young enough that when when Roy got old enough to want to retire, Wes was still considerably younger, so he could step in. The other brothers were too old, really, to do that work. So they became kind of figurehead presidents of the company, but Wes was the guy who ran it. Then came the division of duties between Howard and Jack, and that seemed to have gone pretty well. Howard was named president, Jack was chairman of the board. Howard was in charge of procuring the logs, and Jack was in charge of selling the products that they created, and was a genius at that as well, because he figured out and was very good at, he figured out they couldn't compete with the big people in what they call commodity timber, 2x4s. They could compete in niche products that they were willing to spend some time figuring out how to manufacture mm-hmm. that the big people, the big boys, wouldn't. And so Jack became very good at finding niches that the Hedstroms could fill. And so that's, to this day, that's what they do.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's remarkable how you've found all those facts from early on in the Hedstrom family, because it's not easy, and also been able to follow through the whole story, which is so timely, of course, because this is the 100-year anniversary of Hedstrom Lumber. There's a lot of activities going on in July here now surrounding that. Where can people find this book, Jim?
They can find the book at Drury Lane, at Beth Kennedy's Birch Bark Books and Gifts, at Savers and Gallery, actually. Mm-hmm. And I was told that it might appear at Joints. And I would like to mention that it's published locally. It's Northern Wilds. Mm-hmm. And so Amber Pratt and Sean Parrish deserve a lot of credit for getting this done and doing a good job with it.
And wonderful photographs.
The photographs really make the book. Well, No, not quite. The text
no,
isn't
I don't
quite
think.
The text provides the backbone. They hang the photos off, but the photos are really a lot of fun. There's some mm-hmm. really good ones there.
Yes, there are.
Yeah. So, most of the usual places they can find people
Great.
Can find it.
Well, Jim, I want to thank you so much for joining us here tonight, and also for doing the book. It's just been great for me to see that information, to you know refocus my thoughts about how that all evolved, and also to see photographs of some people that I had a hard time picturing anymore.
Oh, cool. That's
so
it was great.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, that's terrific.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Oh, you're welcome.
Jim Boyd, and the book is called Sawdust in Their Blood, and as Jim mentioned, it's available all through town. I wish we had a little more time because I sure love talking about this.
Oh, good.
We will at another time.